Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cup. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggling.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
All right, we are now episode 584. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin. You are now tuned in to Off the Cuff Radio, and this show is sponsored by Da Vinci Clothing, Buddy Boy Entertainment, Screwball Radio. My host, T-Mask with the Facts, is on the line. What's good?
Man, look, another fantastically excellent Friday on that outstanding OTC frequency, and we are live and direct. Shout out to, of course, DJ Sincere as well from Dirty Basement Radio, and we got a tremendously engaging main event of a marvelous broadcast tonight. When we think about boxing, we think about the pugilism, we think about the essence of the sweet science, everything about dodging, ducking, bobbing, weaving, and all about the skill, the stamina, the training, the hard work, the dedication, the discipline that it takes to get there. It's not an easy mountain to surmount in terms of doing it, but by the same token, when you achieve it, the rewards are so gratifying. We have two brothers tonight on the show representing Floyd Mayweather's money team. Yes, that money team, y'all, TMT, who are the epitome of black excellence, entrepreneurship, family loyalty, and most importantly, understanding their goals and not letting somebody direct and tell them where to go. They already know where they're trying to get the knockout for the success. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we have Cello Tabidi, the manager, and of course his brother, the boxer, Andrew Tabidi. Welcome both of y'all to Off the Cuff Radio. Thank you.
Yo, what's yes, going
what's
on,
good,
man?
What's good?
Yeah,
what's
man,
good,
brother?
Out here.
Great to have you.
Ready.
Shout out to Nene for putting this together for us. Yes, yes.
Oh yeah, big shout out to her, man. Big shout out to her because she definitely be connecting the dots. You feel me?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir, man. How you doing, brother?
We're good. We are great. Gentlemen, you both have excelled in a profession that is at times very unapologetic. It is very unforgiving. It's not an easy business to be in, and you both have excelled in it at so many levels with your success. You have definitely epitomize perseverance in your journey. We're here to hear the story from both of you. I mean, let's get it. Tell everybody about yourself.
Let's get it in.
All right. Well, you know what I'm saying? It's your boy Cello, man. I'm the oldest brother. I'm the big bro. We both born and raised in Chicago. Cabrini Green Project. That's where we came from. That's where we hail from. So we always repping the shy. Man, I mean, it's like you said, it's been a journey, man, coming from where we come from to be where we are now and to be involved in what we into is just a blessing all the way around. You know, little bro live out in Vegas now, you know what I'm saying? So that's where you train at, that's where you work out at, and that's where you get prepared for all his fights. And that's where the money team at. And I'm currently living in VA, where we both always go back to the side every chance we get, for sure.
Absolutely, and both from your lineage, nationality-wise, y'all both are from Nigeria, correct?
No, my pops is from Jamaica.
Okay,
so
Jamaica.
I'm half
okay,
Jamaican. We got the same mom.
Understood.
Yeah.
Okay.
But different dad. His dad is Nigerian.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay, got you.
Yeah.
Okay. Please, and we got to give the other Tabidi his props. Go ahead, man.
What's up, man? How you doing, man? So I don't know where to start, you know. I started boxing at 15 years old. I'm 34 now, and, you know, it's been a crazy journey, man. You know, just everywhere I've been, you know, around the world fighting, you know, being on the top shows of Mayweather shows. And, you know, being on these big stages, man, I worked hard. You know, I'm just appreciative of everything I accomplished, man. And I'm going to continue to, you know, show everybody what I can do. So.
Hey, and I do want to say, man, my brother is very humble, too. So, you know, I have to speak up for him and give him his flowers every time we do any type of interview, because he real chill. He more the laid back one, man. I'm the one that's outspoken and, you know, I'm out here. But little bro, man, little bro been through a whole lot. In the process, man, of becoming a professional athlete. I mean, how far y'all want us to take it back? So we could take it back to, you know, Cabrini Green, or you want us to fast forward?
Dude,
like, where you want me to start?
Because
it's a lot.
we got 2 hours. We can get through all of it. We could do all of it.
Yo, I mean, shoot, for real. I mean, starting back in Cabrini Green, you know, we was exposed to the elements, you know what I'm saying? We grew up in I grew up in the 80s. I'm an 80s mm-hmm. baby, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, just the life in Cabrini Green itself, growing up in the projects in Chicago, you know, I don't really like to glorify the violence and the craziness, the drugs and stuff, but, I mean, y'all know where we come from, man. Y'all know what it is. It's just we grew up in that environment. We didn't let that environment make us who we are today. We didn't let that prevent us from being successful either. And in fact, coming from where we come from, it really gave us the ability to endure the things that we have endured as adults. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It instills those traditional values and put a understanding on your grind. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And for those who don't know the significance of Cabrini Green, if I'm not mistaken, that's actually the setting where Good Times, the TV show, was set at, correct?
Oh, yeah, that's what's
up. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's Chicago.
Good Times, Candyman.
mm-hmm.
All of that.
I mean, but one thing about Chicago is the winning city. You know, known for the city of, as the city of commerce. You know, the Chicago Bulls, Bears, Blackhawks, Cubs, you know, White Sox, North Side, South Side, Garfield Park, everything in between. But it's definitely also been known for GDs, DLs, you know, BGDs, you know. It's, for those that understand the streets out there, it's also a very treacherous place, but it's also birthed some of the best hip hop we've ever heard. You know, coming from Common, you know, No ID. You know, of course, Kanye was born in Atlanta, but he really made his name in Chicago.
And we got to big up my big bro, AK from Do or Die. That's my bro.
Yes, yes,
they did
absolutely.
They thing, you know.
Shout out to him.
Twista.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on. When you growing up in Cabrini-Green, when you think about how far you both have come, what were elements in terms of how you saw it when you both realized the situation that you were in and how you had to make provisions, not only to survive, but ultimately how to plant those seeds that you both will grow to get out of that situation?
Ooh, that's kind of deep. Let me think, man. I mean, you know, me being the older brother, I think it was a little different because I was the protector, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he was young, so I was taking care of him. And we come from an environment where, you know, like, I'm just going to keep it all the way a buck, man. We finna get down and dirty into it. Like, my mom's was, you know, addicted to drugs when we was growing up. So,
right.
You know, we had to play the streets. We had to take care of each other. I had to take care of him, you know, as my little brother. So, you know, just every day, you know, being young myself, trying to make sure I took care of him and protected him and, you know, just being the best big brother I could be at that time, you know, that in and of itself was hard. But when you're in that environment, you don't really see nothing else. You're just trying to survive. So it didn't really hit me until I got out of the environment. But when you in there, it's like, it's just survival of the fittest. Like, you're not really, you know what I'm saying? Like, nothing really clicking on what's outside of there. You just like, man, I'm just trying to make it through another day. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, but Chicago has always birthed those legends, you know, in terms of it. I mean, even in the street, when you think about Elliot Ness taking on Al Capone, when you think about Derrick Rose going to Simeon, when you think about Lupe Fiasco being from Chicago as well. It's not monolithic, even if there's an infamous history, but there's also a grand, distinguished, and relevant and consequential history. When the streets were not, you know, obviously there's more to you than what you both dealt with in the street life. What was it like in terms of the interests you had in terms of athletics, music, just the things, the vices? I don't even want to say vices. Vices is usually connotated with something negative. What were the interests that you both had that would really, 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 like, keep you on a path of, even if you were in the streets, there was never that confusion, and there was always cohesion, and there was always coherence?
Well, I'll let Lil Bro go on that one. You basically, like, hey, bro, what you think as far as, like, that kept you out the street, like, kept you kind of busy mentally?
You know, I feel like it's just the boxing. I had this one trainer, this Mexican trainer, I first came to Vegas. His name was Gil Martinez, and I was scared to even be out of the streets because, you know, he's like someone like a father figure to me at that time. And so, and you know, I just stayed disciplined in the gym because, you know, the workouts was hard, so I was scared to miss. I was scared to miss a week or two because I was scared to fall off, because next time I come, I'll probably get my butt kicked by the smaller kid who was in shape, who stayed in the gym. And, you know, and he was like a hardcore trainer, man. And so, yeah, that was the main thing that kept me out of a lot of trouble was boxing.
And for me, you know, just in Chicago alone, like, I'm going to be real, man, dancing, music. Music kept me kind of focused on, you know, I still went to school, you know what I'm saying? But, like, music was my go-to. I was into music. And, you know, Chicago, we got this Chicago house music that's really, like, big.
Yeah.
You know, in the side. So, you know, the house music became my dancing, you know what I'm saying? Music, the dancing, like, man, I was in dance groups and everything, you know what I'm saying? For real.
That's dope.
Yeah, I was in a group called House-O-Matic, man. It was called House-O-Matic. We used to go crazy, footwork and everything.
And it's crazy, Cello, that you say. It's crazy you say that, Cello, because when you look at Beyonce's album last year, Renaissance, she pays a big homage to the Chicago house theme.
Yep, she sure did.
You know, what was it like in terms of the music scene as it began to really, really flourish in terms of, because this is like the 80s, hip-hop is a burgeoning genre. It's, you know, getting out there. It still hasn't quite gotten to the level of international and world recognition as it is now. You know, it's ubiquitous everywhere. But in the early 80s, it was still a nascent art form that has still yet to be presented to the world at a grand scale. You all, between y'all and New Jersey, you know, in terms of your house, you know, movement with the music, are two of the most well-known for pioneering that. You know, you could even say maybe D.C. at a certain level, because they had their own brand of house. But you all were really the most recognized in terms of bringing that. What was it like in terms of really watching that scene develop?
I mean, for me, just like being in Chicago, being around the entertainment scene and the music scene, like for us, I think watching like the older cats, you know what I'm saying? Like in Chicago. You know, in Chicago, man, it's like a double-edged sword. Like, either you're going to be a gangster and be all the way gangster, or you're going to be, like, doing something else. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's no in-between. So, in a lot of cases, you really don't have a choice but to either be gangster or get involved in something positive if you can, if something's available in your hood that's positive. You know what I mean? So, when it comes to the music, I feel like, you know, the whole music scene, just watching it develop over time, I was into, like, you know, the Do or Die, Crucial Conflict, of course, Common. But we was, like, in Chicago, we really into, like, conscious hip-hop. You know, that's kind of where it started for us. Like, we was really into, like, the conscious hip-hop. And then we started noticing, like, the 8-Ball and MJG era, you know, stuff like that. Scarface started dropping. And then you starting to hear a lot from the South coming up to the Midwest, and I think that's how, like, Do or Die got put on, because, you know, they got signed to, what's his name, Rap-A-Lot, and Rap-A-Lot was down south, so they had a lot of influence on the Chicago music scene, you know, all the Rap-A-Lot artists, so anybody that rapped on Rap-A-Lot, man, was big in Chicago. It kind of created the whole music scene outside of the house music. It was kind of like, the whole music scene in Chicago was from the South, man.
Yeah.
Scarface,
and
King Park,
MJG. Yeah, they definitely have a huge market up in the Midwest, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we didn't really start getting on to that East Coast rap until, like, the mid-90s when you got the Wu-Tangs dropping. You know what I'm saying? The Wu-Tang album, Method Man and Ghostface and all of them. And they swag, you know what I'm saying? So when the swag kind of infiltrated first, and then the music came after that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, and as we saw the scene develop over the years, you know, Twista, you know, was one of the first. I remember, you know, when he used to go by Tongue Twister, and,
you're taking it back.
Man, I mean, yeah, they're taking it way back.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, you know, I mean, and he was definitely somebody who we saw, and we were, you know, we didn't know what to make of it because we had never heard anybody rap like that before.
Hey,
you know, but he eventually,
fact,
yeah, but I mean, he definitely was a dude that really, you know, for the triple time, you know, quick flow, you know, he was one of the guys who really would pioneer that and really honed it in a perspective of was really, it was really more accessible. You know, and hip-hop is all about innovation and creation. But the problem with that type of genius is that not everybody understands it in the time that it is, you know, distributed. But as it goes on, people begin to understand the impactfulness that it has.
And, you know what's interesting? When we talk about, like, Twista, for example, right? Now, Twista come from a different neighborhood than me. So he's a vice lord. So, you know, in his neighborhood, in different vice lord neighborhoods, he was the man. But in my neighborhood, You can't play Twister. Well, not then. When he got big, yeah, everybody kind of accepted him because he's putting on for the city. But, like, when he first dropped, man, wasn't nobody playing Twister. Wasn't nobody on that. Cause, you know what I'm saying? I grew up in a GD neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's so divided in Chicago. Like, we wanted to listen to rappers that was gangsters. You know what I'm saying? We didn't want to listen to Vice World rappers. We wanted to listen to, you know, if you want GD or BD, you know, we weren't trying to really hear it. Until he went mainstream and kind of, you know, I mean, you can't deny his talent. Music got fired. Everybody started saying. But I just remember, like, during those times where if you was in the hood, in my hood, you better not get caught playing Twister. You know what I'm saying? It sounds petty as hell, man, but that's how it used to be for real.
Well, you know, in terms of the street life from L.A. and how Chicago is, we've had so many of our guests, you know, from L.A., you know, who claim sets. We're not going to say who. If you've listened to our shows, you know who we've had and you know who they rep.
All right.
Usually, what was the main differences in terms of how L.A. gets down on their street game and how y'all get down on y'all side with it?
To be real, like, in Chicago, we didn't really do colors. Like, colors is big on the West Coast. Like, out in L.A., you know, the blues, red is blood, that type of thing. In Chicago, it was more like, you know, the 6-point star versus the 5-point star, you know what I'm saying? And then we had the left and the right, so we had sides. So the right side was, you know, GDs, BDs, anything that was gangster, and then the left side was Vice Lords, Stones, and, you know, all of that. So the game, the street life, it just looked different. Like, it's totally different when you look at Chicago and L.A. and compare them. Because in Chicago, you can wear your hat. You can be a neutral, you know what I'm saying, a neutron, that's what we used to call them, which is like a civilian, somebody that's not acting on the streets. You can wear your hat straight. But if it's tilted to the right just a little bit, you're going to get all the smoke from the wrong person. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So growing up, if you didn't want no issues in the streets of Chicago, you just didn't wear a hat. Yeah.
And that's
important. Just like
people at the center of history. Yeah. When you look at guys, the legends like Larry Hoover, Boonie Black, Willie Lloyd, all those guys, what was their influence like there?
Man, big, heavy. I mean, you're talking about the founders of, you know, a lot of the what's going on today in Chicago. You know what I'm saying? So, and I don't have to speak from, you know, what I know as far as Larry Hoover. I mean, the touch is real. Like, the environment, the growth and development mentality has changed. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just the culture of Chicago has changed so much because it used to be structure, right?
Right.
It used to be our gangs used to have, you know, it was set up kind of like the military. It was real militant. It was organized. It was, you know, it wasn't all about violence. Nowadays, it's just totally different because now it's like nothing. Like, there's no structure. There's no chiefs. There's all, everybody wants to be the chief. Like, no, there's no Indians. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody's trying to be the boss. Whereas back in the day, you had that organization and structure where it can be peace. You can see a vice lord and not do nothing because at that time you're not at war. Now, man, it's over with. Everybody at war. For real. Hey, look, and I do want to tell y'all, my brother was driving, so his phone might go out, but he said he's going to call back once he get a signal.
Okay.
He's on the highway going from L.A. to Vegas.
Okay, not a problem. Yeah,
we're
going to
keep it rotating, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to say, too, and, you know, to add on, I'm thinking with the difference between then and now when it comes to the gang culture is that there was actually, from what I'm observing, is there was a little more structure back then. Today, they don't have no structure at all. Everything's like, you got people that's 12 and 13 calling the block shots now. Like, they calling the shots now.
Hey, that's a fact, man. Like my hood gone. So the Cabrini Green, they got knocked down. So that it don't even exist no more. But when you go into like different neighborhoods where you from, and you older, you know, if you was in that life, Like, ain't no more tapping in. You know, ain't no more, like, who you checking in with. You checking in with a 15-year-old that don't know nothing about you. If you're over 35, 30, you know what I'm saying? So it's just like, yo, the world has changed, man, in Chicago. That's why it's so much violence right now. Like, these young boys, man, they don't have no rules, no respect for life. It's just, man, it's like every man for themselves right now in Chicago.
I mean, when we look at some of the stuff, Cello, and we think about what was going on, I mean, we've heard the stories on Off the Cuff. We are never about glorifying or trying to exploit. We simply report the news as it happened. We speak on matters that are public because it was a public issue that happened. When we look at a situation with, you know, King Von, rest in peace, O Block, Lil Snoop from Tukaville, you know, we know about Lil Durk, you know, shout out to his dad, you know, Big Durk as well, you know, FBG Duck, you know, it's, you know, G Herbo. The mix of street and music have become intertwined at certain levels.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of good music, but there has also been a lot of real street issues that have spilled over into it, where back in the day, you kind of halfway tried to keep your street get away from your musical profession. You know, you didn't. But now we're seeing it where there's an open acknowledgement of it. But now we're seeing because.
Back in the day,
go ahead.
Back in the day, you would not catch a rapper disrespecting any gang on an album. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're not going to get Twista disrespecting GDs or, you know, Common or, you know, it just doesn't happen. Nowadays, you know what I'm saying? That's how they get on. Because everybody wants to hear about the beef. Everybody wants to hear about what's going on in each hood. And then to be real, man, these neighborhoods, these dudes that's claiming BD, Lil Durk and all them, man, those neighborhoods are small as hell, man. GDs run the whole Chicago. Like, a lot of people look at it because they're famous and be like, oh, yeah, the BDs, you know, this. Man, that's a small area in the Chi. They just famous.
And
that's it.
And to give further clarity to it, Cello, I mean, how can we be remiss without acknowledging the almighty Latin Kings and Queens Nation, you know, that started in Chicago?
Oh, that's a fact, though. Like, yeah, on the west side of Chicago, Humble Park area. They run it.
Mm-hmm.
They run it. Ain't no question.
Yeah.
I forgot about the Latin Kings, man. And you know what's crazy?
Sure.
I always tell people,
mm-hmm.
Chicago is so like gang affiliated and infiltrated that it goes down into the like corporate in Chicago. Like, there's dudes that you're gonna meet in corporate America, law enforcement. Judges, lawyers, they used to bang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no question. I'm dead serious, man, like, for real. I'm talking about straight-up police officers that's out there working the streets right now today used to get out and bang in Chicago.
Now,
yeah.
You'd be surprised who's banging. Just like a lot of people don't know, that Barry White used to be banged. You know what I'm saying? You don't know who's a banger.
Yeah,
hey,
Barry White was a blood,
though.
I believe. He was a blood, I believe. Barry White was a blood.
That's crazy. I didn't even know that. That's wild.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Now, in terms of the city infrastructure in action, Cello, I know with Mayor Lightfoot, because, you know, you've had the city figures like Lori Lightfoot, Rahm Emanuel, so many issues. I mean, even when we look at some of the political scandals, I mean, of course, with Rob Blagojevich, of course, shout out to President Obama, who was elected president coming from Chicago as a senator. You all have a strong political history as well, you know, from different aspects in terms of, you know,
My favorite mayor was Harold Washington, man. Harold Washington had Chicago coming back. Had the black people united. moving up. Like, it was a, like when he was in there, man, it was a whole different movement and vibe in Chicago. And then, you know, of course, you know, you heard about it. You got a, some people say he got poisoned. I don't know what happened. I don't know the truth behind none of that. I just know he passed and we didn't have him no more. And ever since then, man, it's just, it's no structural organization for the black people in Chicago when it comes to politics. Obama, he became kind of a, you know, like the trophy, like the Chicago trophy, but he didn't do nothing for Chicago. You know what I'm saying? I'm just keeping it real.
He became basically like the face of Chicago.
Yeah, like if you're from the side, you're gonna be proud to be from the side because Obama was the president and he from the side. But he didn't do nothing for Chicago, for the people themselves. It was more so, you know, Harold Washington that was really for the people and really making a difference in neighborhoods. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
but hey,
like
I love Obama. I ain't gonna cap. I love Obama. I got mad respect for him. So I'm not saying nothing bad about it. I'm just saying, like, it is what it is.
Respect.
Yeah, we know how the politics can work out there in terms of where you get in terms of how things go. I mean, when you look at it, and also we can't forget about some of, you know, distinguished news personalities like Bernard Shaw, rest in peace, you know, Allison Payne, you know, people that were really, really integral to the community in terms of reporting the news.
That's a fact.
What did it mean to have people to really be a voice in the media, to really give an accurate description of what was going on, to really resonate and speak for the people?
Wait, say that again. You said,
what did it mean to have people that look like us be in those news outlets who were reporting the news from a perspective of how it was our voice that was being articulated for what was going on?
Oh man, that growing up, that was a big deal. Like seeing a black woman, a black newscast on TV, or a black man, you know, talking about the weather in Chicago was just, I mean, it was inspirational because it's like, yo, now you see one of us doing something positive. You see a black man that's on TV, that's a news anchor, or a black woman, or, you know, even on the radios, when you talk about, you know, some of our radio stations, WGCI, we had some of the biggest names of, you know, radio hosts coming through Chicago. So just knowing that they looked like us and they represented us, and when we heard them speak, they sound like us, man, that in and of itself was really motivation to, you know, get out the lifestyle, get out the streets and look at possibly, you know, creating a better life for yourself, doing something different outside of hustling. You know, I know for sure, for me personally, I'm gonna speak on for me, when I used to see them, I saw opportunity. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's almost like an escape. You know, imagine being 12 years old and being happy to hear the news or watch the news or just listen to the voices on the radio. You know what I'm saying? In the projects, it's like, dang, hey, yo, where they at? Like, where is WGCI? Like, how they was the celebrities. For real, like, man, let the news come through, and it's one of the sisters or brothers, man. They out there, man, everybody going to flood the streets for them. And this was back in the day, not now, but this was back then.
Man, look, growing up out here in Virginia, Hampton Roads, we used to have WGN on cable. So that was like, we definitely used to love WGN.
Oh, WGN. Y'all can get back to the 90s with that one. We used to watch some bowl games up there.
Yeah.
WGN, hey, oh my God.
Yo, you just brought it back for me, WGN. I ain't heard that in a minute.
Man, those Bulls games were everything. Shout out to Scotty, Mike, Dennis, Phil, Doug, Paxton, Bill Cartwright, all the old Bulls legends, man. I mean, that was...
Hey, look, that Bulls run was something historical, man. Like, in the city, man, it was historical. I'm talking about, you go outside when the Bulls playing and Jordan on that court, man, ain't nobody outside.
I know them celebrations were crazy. You know, whatever they won the championship, I know them celebrations was nuts.
Oh, man. Hey, the celebrations was beyond nuts. You know, of course they looted and rioted. You know what I'm saying? Like, so upset. But outside of that, man, the celebrations was fire. I'm talking about whole neighborhoods throwing parties because the Bulls won.
Man, look. I know with Michael, because Michael obviously was carrying a lot of heavy weight around there. I know there was a couple of guys. I know most notably Ronnie Fields. I know Ronnie Fields, another Chicago legend. You know, of course, you know, Kevin Garnett came to Farragut Academy up there from South Carolina.
Man,
yeah. But Ronnie Fields was a heavy baller, and, you know, he challenged Mike to a one-on-one. You know, Mike never accepted, but, of course, you had, what, other playground ballers like Billy the Kid, Davis, and all those guys.
Man, when you go into the street balling was serious in Chicago, man. We used to always have celebrity, like, NBA players come to Chicago and do pickup games, and they used to have a cage around it. And a matter of fact, the court, the basketball court they used to play at was right there in Cabrini Green.
Who did y'all see come over there to play?
Oh, man. Whenever Jordan or Pippen came out there, I saw, what's his name, man? I want to say BJ Armstrong. What's that little short dude? Spud Webb. I don't know if y'all remember Spud Webb.
Oh, yeah.
Him coming out
there. Number four for the Hawks. They won the dunk contest. Still the shortest dunker ever at 5'8".
Yeah, bro. Hey, seeing him out there was crazy. Who else? Dominique Wilkins. I'm just speaking on who I saw personally.
Okay.
Any and everybody from the Bulls. We always used to see a lot of the Bulls guys out there. Even some of the white Bulls players would be out there, you know, just standing around and stuff, flicking up with the kids. I'm trying to think of who else came out there that's like famous.
But I mean, you had guys like Nick Anderson and Kendall Gill from Chicago who played. You know, from the city who played. Both of them played at Illinois, the Fighting Alumni.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the balling is deep, and we're not even getting into the football team with guys like Juice Williams, you know, Simeon Wright. Lou Tepper used to be coached back in the day. You know, all those guys. I remember that old, the old Big Ten. You know what I'm saying? I mean, Juwan Howard, you know, played in Michigan. He's
Juwan Howard, yeah.
Yep.
That's right. And you know what? That's one of the things that I also can say I use to keep my head on straight with sports. Outside of, like, dancing and music, having the access to different sports. And I'm gonna tell you a quick little story, man.
Go ahead.
When I was growing up in Cabrini, right? I was growing up in Cabrini. Now, at this time, my brother was really little, so he's not really a part of this story. But I had to be like 10, 11, trying to get on the baseball team, and it wasn't a school team. It was like one of those, you know, the white people come in the neighborhood. They set up like a little organization. You play, you know, they do pickup or whatever. Well, our team was all black from Cabrini Green. We went to go in first game. Everybody was on 10, man. Everybody was excited. You know, it was crazy. We didn't even have uniforms, but we had all white tees, and we had matching shorts. Somebody gave us baseball cleats, and we had, you know, like the little hats and stuff. We get to the field, and we thinking we about to play. And this lady came up, and this is no joke, bro. I remember this like yesterday. She said, "My son is not playing against no niggas."
Wow.
And they didn't let us, and they stopped us from playing, bro. You talking about some, like, everybody was crushed, bro. Like, everybody was crushed. And that just turned, it turned me away from baseball completely. And I started, you know, focusing on football, you know what I'm saying? But that was just one of my experiences I remember growing up in Chicago, trying to get involved with sports and having, because, you know, Chicago is really, it's diverse, but is also very segregated. You know what I'm saying?
Understood.
And being that Cabrini Green is like 5 blocks from the Gold Coast, which is the wealthiest area in Chicago, those are the kids that we would have been playing against, but because we came from where we came from, they didn't want to accept our team. And, you know, the coach was sad. My mom was out there cursing and screaming at people. You know what I'm saying? It was just one of those crazy experiences, man, that you just never forget in life. And that was, you know what I'm saying, that was somewhat traumatic, man, but it was just like, dang, like, y'all tripping on us playing sports? Like, we can't do nothing.
You know, and that is something that I think that is why we have to understand how important it is for our babies to have an opportunity. You have people that will try to say that racism in this country does not exist. Bullshit, it does.
Yeah, that's definitely bullshit.
And the one thing about
especially when you look at Jello. Yeah, I was gonna add this on too about the segregation part of Chicago. That should even go back to when even Martin Luther King was fighting out there to get black people housing rights, because even the mayor out there was discriminating against. Name was on, I think it was on Mayor Daley or something.
Richard Daley, Richard M. Daley, yeah.
Richard, yeah, man.
Yeah.
It goes deep.
But one thing about it too is that there's always an element of what you always think about it is. Every child should have an opportunity in this world to do something from an aspect of being able to succeed, you know, no matter what walk of life, you know, and that is something that is sad because, you know, when we think about it, no child should ever be subjected to that type of racist harassment and dismissal because of their ethnicity. You know, no child should ever have. That joint Keanu Reeves, that movie he did, you know what I'm saying, with the Little Leaguers, that was real. That was a real story.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know what I'm saying? You know, and that was something where it really was indicative of what, you know, we face. I think baseball, understanding this over the years about how a lot of black people were not necessarily, you know, that's why they started the RBI Foundation, you know, the outreach program to get kids of color into baseball. Because people got to understand, it's not like basketball where you can shoot on a hoop and sharpen your skills and dribble. Baseball is a team sport, literally. It is the one sport where one person, a pitcher, can decide whether or not a team loses the game. If he's got his good shit out there and he strikes everybody out, the team is going to win. You know, as long as his team can hit the ball. You know, but it's always been an issue that if you don't really have access to it in terms of, a league to play in, the equipment in terms of a bat, glove, and a ball, how can you really get into it? You know, and Chicago had its legends. You know, of course, Ryan Sandberg, Kerry Wood on the Cubs. Of course, the White Sox. You had Bo Jackson play, you know what I'm saying?
Don't forget
Robin
about
Ventura.
Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, Sammy Sosa. Sammy Sosa. Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, Albert Bell, when he played for the White Sox, you know, and closing his career. During that whole time, Chella, what was it like to watch that Sammy Sosa experience in 1998 with him and Mark McGwire chasing it?
Hey, look, man, I ain't even gonna lie to you. Everybody I grew up with thought Sammy Sosa was black. We didn't even know he was Hispanic.
Dominican. Yeah, he's Dominican.
yeah, he's Dominican, man. We was looking at him like a black man. We was like, hey, Sammy Sosa is us. We rocking with him all the way. But, yeah, it was just, you know, at that time, I feel like I had got out of baseball, but I only loved it because Sammy Sosa was like a black face that was killing the game, that was in it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, of course, you know, Sosa, everything, jerseys, hats, anything involving them. That's the only time you'll see a lot of people in the side rocking his gear. Like, that's it.
Understood. Now, you said you transitioned to playing football. What was that like for you? Because obviously y'all had the Monsters of the Midway with the Bears at Soldier Field. I mean, you know, the 46
that helped us out.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So getting into football being younger was easier because there was a lot more programs coming from the Bears to the underprivileged neighborhood. So getting a football team, getting into that football network as a youngster was a lot easier. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like AAU now, but back then it was just like the black teams played against the black teams, different neighborhoods played against neighborhoods, south side against the west
right.
side. You know what I'm saying? So we didn't have like a it wasn't as organized as it is now, but it was definitely an avenue, and it gave us access to learn the sport and to potentially become, you know, a college football player or NFL player, you know, things of that nature. But, I mean, for me, man, I loved it. It was a release. It was a getaway. Man, you don't know what it's like to get away from Cabrini and be on a bus going somewhere else and being able to, like, sleep in a hotel as a kid and mentally relax. As a kid, I felt that way. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Man, 45 minutes in, and we're getting all this fantastic history here on Off the Cuff.
Sure, man. We just touched on the Chicago sports history and culture alone.
Yeah,
man.
I'm like, look. I'm like, look, so it's like we haven't even gotten into, like, you know, the heavy stuff, man, in terms of, like, you know, how you would end up transitioning. Yo, for all people listening, if you want to call in, the call number is 1-516-531-9596. You know, we got Cello and Andrew Tributi on the show. So, yeah. So,
yeah, tap okay. in with us, man. Hop on, holler at me. Any of my people
Absolutely.
That see this, hey, make sure y'all hit us up. Get on here.
Yeah. So how would this ultimately, in terms of where you, because obviously you are a highly successful entrepreneur in terms of boxing manager and so many other endeavors. So
yeah.
Where does the path for you, Cello, start from the football in terms of laying the roots for where you would end up to now? We still got time. So, I mean, take us
okay.
through all.
So I'm going to take you through it. So, all right. When I first got into high school,
okay.
I went to Lincoln Park High School. I got mm-hmm. on the football team at Lincoln Park High School, and I was getting really good grades. You know, I was a straight A student in middle school. I don't know how I did it, but I did. I was a straight A student, got into high school, went to Lincoln Park. At that time, my mom was recovering. So she was a recovering addict, and they did a story on her in the New York Times. And it's this guy named Jason DePaul. He was a reporter. He was a reporter, or what do you call it? Like he used to write for him. A journalist. There you go. He was a journalist for the New York Times, and he came to stay with us. He came to live with us for like 6 months, you know, just to see how we was moving, see how my mom was surviving, being on welfare and recovering, and how the life was. Like, they did a big story on it. Well, what happened was, This guy, Jason DePaul, he ended up taking a liking to me, and he started talking to me about this private school that was off in Colorado, and it was a high school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So I was like, you know, in my mind, I'm like, man, I'm Chicago. Like, I can't leave my mama and my brother. Like, you know, that's not the way to do it. Like, I got to figure out something here. But over time, he became my mentor. He started taking me places. Like, he took me to New York, right? And he showed me the New York Stock Exchange. We on the floor at the New York Stock Exchange. Like, literally, I see them running tickets and I hear bells. I see people moving money, and he's educating me. This is where I got exposed to life outside of the hood, but on a positive level. Like, on a you can make it if you put your mind to it level. You know what I'm saying? Like, the exposure is what really changed my mind, as opposed to just hearing about it or seeing it on TV. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was in New York, and I sat there, and I seen this. He took me to the White House. I went to Washington, D.C. I met Bill Clinton's daughter. What's her girl name?
Chelsea.
Yeah, I met her, took pictures with her and everything. Like, went into the Oval Office. I got pictures of me standing at the podium that the president speaks speaks on. You know what I'm saying? Like, these are things that he exposed me to that created that curiosity of, okay, maybe if I do something different, I can get a different outcome than continuing to, you know, try to sell drugs and be in the street and, you know, do the things that I already knew the outcome of that. It was either jail, death, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, you already know what's going to go down on that one. So I was like, man, this is an opportunity. I think I'm going to step out on faith and try it, man. My mom's was pushing me to go because she didn't want me in the hood anyway. He was my mentor, so he was telling me the opportunities that would come to me. And I stepped out on faith, man. I left my sophomore year at Lincoln Park, went to a school in Colorado called Eagle Rock High School. It's a boarding school. It's like a it's a private school, so you know, you get a lot of rich kids there, but you also get people like me who get tuition paid and all that type of stuff. So I was there on a scholarship. Didn't have to pay for nothing. He knew the dean at the time, he knew everybody. So he pretty much got me in the school. And man, from there it was beautiful. I was exposed to a whole new culture. I was being exposed to new people. My lifestyle changed, you know what I'm saying? I still have my issues as far as trusting people and how to converse and talk and fit in, because I was so, at that time, I was just so, like, aggressive. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was, mm-hmm. I was young, street aggressive, and I'm being put into an environment where I don't even have to do that no more. You know what I'm saying? Because that's a defense mechanism, for real. So I was put into this environment where I didn't have to be so mean to people and not trust people, that started impacting me in my mindset. And now I'm learning new things. I'm learning new cultures. I'm learning new languages. I'm seeing different races get along. I'm meeting white people that like black people. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was my first experience kicking it with a white person, was in high school, and we was cool. Like, he was a straight country boy from Colorado, cowboy, and I was a Chicago nigga from the hood, you know what I'm saying? But he ended up being one of my best friends, man. His name's CJ. Shout out to CJ. CJ live in California somewhere now. But yeah, man, like, that right there, those events turned my life around. So when I got out of high school, went through high school, when I got out, I was trying to figure out a way to pay for school. Now, remember, you know, my mom, she's still back and forth with the drugs. Pops, he moving weight, but he not around. You know what I'm saying? And I'm trying to figure out, okay, I'm getting out of high school. I got to figure out what I want to do. Like, what's the move? And all these decisions that I'm making in life from the time I was 12 to the time I graduated high school, man, I made those decisions. Like, I didn't have any guidance for it other than my mentor that was kind of showing me the opportunities that I could have. You know what I'm saying? So, like, choosing to go to Colorado was a choice I made. I didn't have a father or a mother that was supportive, like, hey, you can go and we're going to send you money and take care of you while you out there. I went out there poor and broke. And the whole time I was there, I was poor and broke. But I got my high school diploma out there. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, you know, life takes you on these journeys and you just don't know what's going to come out on the other end. So long story short, I went through high school. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to go to college. I said, forget it. I'm going to go back home when I graduate. I'm going to go to Illinois State University because it's a state school. It's probably not going to be that expensive. I'm going to figure out a way how to pay for it when I start school. That was my mentality. Like, I got to go to college. Well, the first semester came and they sent me that bill. You know how it goes. you get that bill for your books and all of these things, and I don't have nobody to navigate me, to tell me, you know, there's scholarships, there's things you can do to get funding for your books and your school tuition. So I went straight back to what I knew best, just hustling. So I'm like, all right, I can hustle a little bit of money, pay for my books. And then I met a recruiter for the United States Army, and he sold me a dream, and I joined the United States Army, bro. And that's where everything for me changed completely.
Now,
let me keep going because I got more. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, we got plenty of time. Now, one thing about Cello, so before we get way ahead, one thing about is, and this is something that people have to understand, every child born in the ghetto is not doomed to failure. And a lot of times all it is about the opportunity to have an outlet. You know, you were fortunate, obviously. And a lot of other, you know, youngsters are fortunate to make up out the hood, you know, because somebody believes in them. But it's one thing about it is where people will complain about our youth being crazy. And, you know, yeah, we see crazy situations. We see shit that's not ideal for what they have to deal with. But that doesn't mean that the outcome is hopeless. Now, youth understood that at an age where, even being younger, that you wanted more and this might be the one chance that you have to get more. And you took for that turn. It carried you where you needed to go. So you were able to make that. It's all about transition and evolution. And you did.
Oh, go ahead.
And you did.
And check this out. I always tell people, like, so when I jump off the porch, like, it's always interesting to me when I hear about guys that being a, you know, 30s and 40s and 50s and they still game banging and they still active. It's so weird to me because in Chicago, like, I had my first gun when I was 9. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was carrying a gun at 9 years old. I was riding a bus in the city of Chicago by myself at 9 years old to go visit my grandma on the west side, to go see my uncle on the south side, go check my auntie out the southwest in the suburbs. Like, I'm making moves like that at 9, and I can't even imagine. I have a 9-year-old. I have an 8-year-old daughter. I can't even imagine the mentality of – I can't picture her doing what I had to do, or my son, for that matter, doing what I had to do at that age just to – like, live a regular life, just to be able to, you know, go somewhere, to be able to travel. Like, literally, man, I was 9 years old clutching a .38. That was my first gun. I ain't going to say who gave it to me.
Understood. No, this is off the cuff, Taylor. We had that talk before the show. We are not incriminating nobody, ever.
Yeah, because look, he's still out here, you know what I'm saying? He's still out here.
He's a family man
now, and I don't want nobody to look at him different, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, man, like, you know, coming up in the streets like that and living in that environment, man, like, I'm 9 years old riding from Cabrini Green, and I'm going to paint the picture for you. A 9-year-old, I'm about, at that time, maybe 5'5". I'm standing at the bus stop by myself. I'm riding from Cabrini Green on Halsted and Division. I have to take the bus from Division all the way down to the west side of Chicago where I hit Madison and Pulaski and those areas, right? Now, the whole time, I'm riding through Latin King neighborhood. So here I am, and now I'm going to go into the story of what happened. One of my bad experiences on a bus. So I'm on the bus by myself, always sitting in the back. I'm riding on the bus, man, and I'm going through, riding on Division. I'm going through the Puerto Rican neighborhood. When you get to the neighborhood, it's a huge flag that covers the whole street. Like, it's literally a metal flag, and it covers the whole street. You got to go under it to go through it. It's right next to the Bull Stadium. That's where it starts. So I'm on the bus. These guys, they see me. Now, I'm a kid. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not thinking they finna mess with me, but I'm also prepared because I know mentally this is what go down. So I'm sitting in the back, and all these Latin Kings get on the bus. They don't pay. They come straight to the back, and they all sitting around next to me. All of these dudes got to be in their, like, teens and 20s. Like, I'm a young kid, bro. Like, this is no joke. I'm sitting in the back. One of the dudes, he opens his jacket, and he shows me a gun. And I'm...
King, we still got him?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, hold on. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, where's Cello? We got Cello, or did it go out?
You might have to call back. I think his call dropped. I'm going to have to call back in. Yeah, he's going to call back probably. Yeah, he's probably going to call back in a minute. Sometime that
okay.
happens.
Yeah, man. Look, off-the-cuff radio. We got the Tabidi brothers, you know, Cello and Andrew on, you know, just talking about Chicago history, you know, and the sports history, everything, the Windy City wonderfulness and greatness. But, yeah, man, so, I mean, look, we done got a lot of jewels so far.
Yeah, man, everything shot time. Okay,
yeah,
you got
we definitely have got. Okay, we got him. Yeah, Cello,
yeah,
you good?
Okay, I'm back. Yeah, I
okay,
think
yeah,
that was
so
my
go
signal.
Ahead,
I think
so
that was
dude,
my signal.
Yeah, so the dude shows the heat. So
yeah,
what else
so he
happens?
He flashes his gun, and I'm sitting there, and I got my backpack on. I got my little 38 in my little waist, you know what I'm saying? And I'm like, there's no way I'm going to be able to fight my way out of this situation. These all big adults to me. They look like grown men, but they really was in their teens. And I'm like, man, I just sat there, and I started praying. I said, Lord, please help me make it to my grandma's house. That's all I kept saying. I was like, man, I got to get out of here. I got to figure out a way to get out of here. Man, we came to a bus stop. And at this bus stop, it was two police officers standing at the bus stop. And I just got up. I stood up, and I started walking towards the exit to get off the bus. The dude grabbed me and threw me down in the seat, and the police saw it. The police got on the bus and kicked all of them off and allowed me to ride the bus, man. And I'm telling you, that's what saved my life that day, because I knew for sure they was going to kill me on that bus.
Now, and God bless. For people to say God ain't real, fuck what y'all saying. God is real.
Man, God
we'll
beyond real. For real.
But this is also a cautionary tale, Cello, about what the gang life was. Obviously, you know, you're GD. What was the rivalries like between the gangs at the times, especially with the GDs and Latin Kings during that time? How serious was it when one saw the other that smoke would jump off?
Oh, it's on sight. As soon as you see, and then that's another thing too, because the Latin Kings, it was really pretty much they was warring against anybody black. So the Latin Kings didn't like nobody. You could be Vice Lord, GD, BD, whatever. If you was black going through their neighborhood, it was an issue. And vice versa. You know what I'm saying? If you got caught lacking and you was a Spanish dude and you might not even be Latin King. If you just get caught, it's over. So that was my moment where I knew it was over for me. But the gang activity back then, now, mind you, I do want to keep it 100. Like, I'm not, at that time, I'm not active. Like, I'm not banging. You know what I'm saying? I'm just trying to survive.
Right,
I'm
right.
just living.
You're just having protection.
I'm from the hood. Yeah, yeah. So I'm from the neighborhood, but I'm not actively going out looking for, you know, I'm not doing that type of stuff. I'm just trying to survive and get to my grandma's house and get to school and, you know what I'm saying, move around Chicago, visit family. So, but anyway, the activity on the gang side, man, it's straight up war. You know what I'm saying? At that time, wasn't no peace. It was just, hey, on site, you're a vice lord, it's murder. If it's, you know, you're a Latin King, it's murder, and vice versa. So it wasn't no talking, wasn't no, you know, trying to get nobody no passes, wasn't no check.
What was the impetus for those race politics out there like it was?
Wait, say that again?
What was the impetus for those race politics in terms of the warfare in the street like that?
You said the politics?
The impetus. Why was it the way that it was? Because you would figure, you know, with the black and brown, that it really, yeah. Was it just gang affiliated or was it a deeper race issue between them?
It was all gang affiliated. It wasn't with the Latinos and all that. It was all, everything was gang affiliated for sure. But it was just like, you might go, you know what I'm saying? Like somebody goes somewhere from the hood, they get killed, right? The dude that killed them,
right,
it's Hispanic. He might not even be a Latin King, but it's just the fact that he was Hispanic and he killed the brother. Now it's war again. You know what I'm saying? And the temperature goes up and down in Chicago. Like, the summertime, I'm going to say it's the worst time to be a black male on the shot. The wintertime, the spring, you good. But summertime shot, man, that's the most violent season of the year for everybody. Like, everybody's catching bodies, man.
But I will say this, though, for the summertime, there is one song that I think beats Will Smith's Summertime, and you know where I'm going with this. M-Doc featuring Shante Savage. It's a summer thing.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's crazy.
Summer thing. Man.
Hey,
1993. Man, when I first heard, I still got that on a 12-inch.
Hey,
when I first heard that, I was like, whoa.
Dang.
But yeah. So when you think about, so we've gotten to that part about, you know, what it was like for you as a shorty. So now we go into the part of you when you go into the Army. So what was that like in terms of that part of the story?
Oh, man. So I'm in college, my first year of college. I'm getting these bills that I'm not used to seeing. I know it's my responsibility to pay them, and I want to stay in school. So, you know, meet this recruiter. He starts telling me about the Army and the money I can make and how they pay for your tuition and all of these things. And I'm just like, man, I need that. Like, I need a way to pay for my tuition, you know. And then I used to cut, too. I used to cut hair just to kind of hustle in college, too, just to, you know, get my little money. But anyway, I ended up joining the Army. I was infantry. So, you know, wasn't nothing special for real. I was a straight-up combat warrior. So fast forward, this is 2000 when I signed up for the Army. No, my bad. 99, I signed up for the Army. I don't go out for basic yet. I'm still in school. So I'm in school for a year, almost 2 years. 9/11 happened, 2001, September. I'm in class. I'm sitting in class. I'll never forget it. I'm sitting in class. I'm like, man, I hope I don't have to be a part of this. You know what I'm saying? Like, in my mind, I'm just like, man, I hope this is not the time where they about to send me off to war. And lo and behold, I got that message. I got that phone call, and I had to go. I was shipped out to Fort Benning, Georgia. And that's what I did, all of my training for the infantry. So I went straight from basic training for 9 weeks to infantrymen training, which was 14 weeks. Then I went air assault. Then I went airborne. And then I was over in Afghanistan in November, December. I was in Afghanistan in November of 2001. No, 2002. So actually, I got two tours. I did two tours in Afghanistan. This is the part where it gets crazy. My first tour, I come back, right? I come back. I'm all excited. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm a soldier. I got my uniform on. I'm going to visit family. I'm going to everybody's house. I'm back. You know what I'm saying? I got a fat bank account. I'm like, man, I'm up. You know, I'm feeling good. I'm proud of myself. I got, like I said, I got my uniform on. I'm in the best shape of my life. I go out west to visit my grandma. She lived in K-Town. So when I first got back, I went and bought a motorcycle. So I'm on my motorcycle. I pull up, you know, I go inside, kick it with my grandma, my grandfather, a bunch of the younger cousins, my auntie Tut, rest in peace, Tut. And I'm just enjoying family, man. I'm back in Chicago, I done survived through a tour of war. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never wanted to go to war. I just wanted to pay for school. So I'm back. I survived. I'm excited. I'm living life to the fullest. I got like $40,000 in the bank account. You know what I'm saying? Like, I got more money than I ever had in my life at this time. I'm on my way out of the house, out of my grandma's house. Saying bye to everybody. I'm leaving. A young boy, when I walk through the gate to leave out, I'm walking out of the gate to the sidewalk. This young boy walk up on me. He like, yo, give me the keys to your bike. I'm looking at him. I'm like, man, get your ass out of here. Like, when I say young, man, little homie had to be at least 12, 13 at the time. So I'm like, man, get your ass up out of here. So I kind of like, I muff him. You know what I'm saying? And when I say muff him, I don't know if y'all know what that means, but I put my hand on
push him out the way. Yeah, just push him out
the
way.
Yeah. Like, little homie, stop playing with me. Like, get out of here. He up a pistol on me. So he pulled a gun out, and I'm like, oh, hold on. So I give him the key. I dropped the key to the bike on the ground. I didn't know it was two more guys with him, and they ran up on me, and we started fighting. So I'm fighting two dudes.
Oh, wow.
And this little young boy, he got my key, and he got the pistol. So I'm more worried about the little young boy with the gun than the niggas I'm fighting. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out, I got to kick the gun away or figure out a way to get this young boy away from me because he got the, I don't want to die. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to get to him so I can get the gun away and shoot them or get the gun away and run.
Understood.
Anyway,
look,
I end up fighting. Yeah. You want me to keep?
No.
I couldn't even hear you.
Now, when it go down.
Oh, okay, my bad.
That's when it's survival. Go down. Go ahead.
So I'm squabbing. I'm fighting two niggas, man. I don't know who they are. They don't know me. Got this young boy pointing the gun at me. Finally, I still on the little young boy with the gun. He dropped it. I take off. I don't even run to my bike. I run to the middle of the street so that I can run away, like literally run down the street. And as I'm running, I hear the shots going on. Bah, bah, bah. He just letting it ride, running. So I'm running. I'm dipping through cars, in between cars. Like, I'm on the west side of Chicago running in the middle of the street, running in between cars so I don't get shot. I end up getting shot three times.
Cool.
And I tried to hide. Yeah, I made it, like, two blocks away, but the young boy chased me. I didn't know he was chasing me. So the young boy is running behind me shooting. I'm thinking they shooting from way down the street. So anyway,
right.
I got hit three times, so I'm like, damn. So I fall, and I try to hide under a car, and I couldn't fit under the car, and he walked and stood straight over me and pointed the gun at my face, and I put my hand up, and he shot me, but he ended up shooting me through my wrist. And my wrist, the bullet went through my wrist, but my hand hit my face so hard, it knocked me out. And I woke up in the hospital.
So he thought he killed me.
Oh, yeah, he thought he killed me for sure. But I woke up in the hospital, and I'm just like, man, like, I can't talk. I'm like, you know, I'm burning everywhere. My mind is racing. I don't know how I got here. I'm confused. I'm weak. I'm in pain. Like, it was just all over the place. And the saddest part about it, bro, I didn't have nobody's phone number. I couldn't call nobody because I had just got back. So I'm literally popping up on people. You know what I'm saying? Like, when I'm going to people's house, I ain't got no cell phone. I'm pulling up because I remember the address. So I'm in the hospital by myself recovering from gunshot wounds, and I can't call nobody. I ain't got nobody to come visit me. And I was in the hospital for like 6 weeks. No, like 4 weeks by myself.
Man,
so I go to war. Don't come back unscathed, and then I get my Purple Heart in Chicago. Shit is wild, bro. Like, for real.
But you know, but that's something though, Cello.
Yeah.
And we, where do I start with that? The hood. Well, there are certain places. I don't know if you've made it out to Hampton Roads. We'll definitely have to connect if you come down here, you know, do lunch, dinner, whatever, and just chop it up.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that if you're from the hood, especially if you're black, you really understand what goes on. And the thing is, Chicago is one of those hoods, because any hood that's got some bad shit, it can jump off. But Chicago is one of those hoods that's known that shit can jump off at any point. But, you know, you go out Norfolk, Portsmouth, especially Newport News and Hampton, you got to be careful out there because,
you know,
and this is 99 when you get hit. So, well, when did you come home? When did you come home after the first tour?
Oh, after my first tour, I got back exactly 1 year later. So,
okay, so this is 2000.
Yeah. No. I joined the military in 99. I didn't get activated until after 9/11. So 9/11
that's 2002.
Right. 9/11 happened in September. I got activated in November, and I was already boots on the ground in Afghanistan.
And see, what people got to understand, this is kind of where, because in certain places like L.A. and Chicago and New York and Miami, this was kind of already a thing. We're not here to glorify it on off the cuff, but we're just speaking street facts. You know, there are certain places where you got those kids, they've already, matter of fact, to give context to it, in Florida some months ago, they arrested a 12-year-old, I think, for a murder. But, you know, you got some of these kids out there that are already deep in the streets. You know, so, you know, that's just what they do. And it can happen anywhere. That's why I tell anybody, you know, and just in general, any hood, try to keep a low profile. If you know it's a wild place, don't wear anything flashy. Don't do none of that because you never know who's lurking. Because some of them young boys, I mean, especially now in this time in hip-hop, we're seeing more and more young people. Now, this is one thing, too, because on Off the Cuff, we talk about all aspects of the culture. The drill music scene. Chicago is pretty much recognized as where the drill music scene started. What are your thoughts about it from being a native and being a hip-hop connoisseur and this, that, and the other about how that started and how that – because you actually were in that life, so you really have an understanding of it. Please, go ahead.
I'm going to keep it real with you, man. A lot of these dudes that's drill rappers, they rapping about what they really did because you got to think back then – they wasn't selling drugs. The dope boys were my age. These were the guys that you was giving the gun to or giving the green light to go do your work because they was the youngins. And they got less time or they got no time. So as they grew up, they became, they were the hitmen. So all of these dudes that's rapping, King Von, Lil Durk, all of but none of them niggas was real dope boys. They wasn't into, like, selling drugs. They was really about killing niggas. Like, that's how they made money. Chief Keef, that whole crew, 300, all of them, they wasn't dope boys, man. You ain't see them niggas with no, you know what I'm saying, flashy cars and all the money and all that stuff until they started rapping and they got on. But they literally were the hitman back in the day for the older cats. So now that they become older and they start rapping, that's what they rap about. And that's kind of like, that's what took the shift in Chicago, is those guys grew up. And instead of being the dope boys, they became the killers. And everybody, all the young boys are killers in the side. And that's just, this is what you get out of it. You know what I'm saying? That's the culture that we created.
That Chicago smoke is different. Because we've known the history from the streets and how it evolved. Shout out to Lil Durk for what he's been doing with his musical career, really taking off.
Yep.
Of course, his dad, Big Durk, you know. But one thing about it is we know Big Durk was real, and we know Lil Durk is. Look, when that situation happened a couple of years ago when niggas ran up and Durk House, remember that Keenan Cello? And, Durk and his girl were busting back at him.
Yep.
It's like a movie.
That's crazy. But you know, anytime you see something like that, man, that's an inside job. You know what I'm saying? That's somebody that already was linked in with him. That wasn't no enemy.
Right.
Yeah, that was definitely somebody that already knew him. Yeah. That was in the they wasn't in the inner circle. They was like one of them people around him that's in the outer circle, but had enough information to do something like that. Yeah.
And that's important.
Yeah, I was going to Yeah, I was going to say this too, man. It just goes into tune with what that culture is like. Like, they got to show them really what they rap about. I mean, that's like a part of the pressure that, you know, they have a lot of the executives and labels put on these artists these days. Because there used to be a time where you let your art speak for yourself. You just sell the art.
Right.
Now, today, you got to sell the image behind the art.
Yeah, that talk, that's real though, and that's where the young boys' mentality is, because now they see one dude get on, and he was a killer, and now he rapping. Now all of them want to be killers first, and then go into rap, and that's what Chicago is dealing with.
Man, this is, oh God, we still got damn near 40 minutes left. I mean, this is great with the content we're getting, talking about this, because this is some real history. The people, this is one thing for our listeners that they need to understand about this, in terms of this is not just some fly-by-night phenomenon that just came out of nowhere. This has been going on, and this kind of grew into this monster that it is now. You know,
right,
we're seeing the proliferation of violence because, you know, even with the rap beef that went on, and we're all old enough to remember this, you know, when, you know, Stan and KRS went at it, LL and Kumo D were going at it, you know.
I remember when Cannabis was going at it with LL too, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I mean,
we
never thought anything of it. Now, Biggie and Tupac, that was something we kind of had an inkling
that
maybe something could happen. When the Dog Pound Killer got shot up in New York back in 95, after they did the New York video, we kind of knew that. We kind of knew something. we kind of knew something could happen. But that's something now we've seen a level of violence where we have seen so many rappers getting killed. And it's like, you know, when I saw that video with FBG Dead Bitches a couple years back, I was telling King about this. I was telling him, nigga, I had to go take a shower. I had to burn some sage. Because I was like, and I mean, because the video just had a very dark feel to it.
Maybe you made you renounce the culture.
Hey,
I mean, but watching that video, you knew, it just, like the Bible said, there's life and death in the tongue. And with all that shit FBG Dutt was talking in that video, you just knew, especially in the shot, how they get down. Exactly.
There's going to be some repercussions.
Exactly.
Sure.
And they slid on them and they got them. You know? Yeah. So it's like, you know, but that's how you got to be careful out there, yo, because you just don't know. Go ahead.
One thing I learned in Chicago, I don't care who you are. I ain't even going to say just Chicago. Just in life in general, man. Nobody is untouchable. Nobody is unreachable. If the person is crazy enough, they gonna get you if they want you. You know what I'm saying? And that's why I try to make sure I live my life where I don't go around trying to create enemies. I'm going around trying to create connections, build brotherhoods and sisterhoods. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, bro, I've seen so much death, so much pain. Man, you know how many funerals I've been to? How many black suits I've wore? How many white tees, airbrush white tees I done wore, all in the name of what? You know what I'm saying? Like, so much death, man. I'm talking about, I've been to over 20 funerals, easy, just growing up in Chicago. And that's not even my adult life. I'm just talking about my childhood. Easy 20 funerals, 20 to 30 funerals, easy.
Yeah, and see, that's something that people really, really have to understand in terms of what do the kids have to understand today about what the criminal life means in terms of what can happen to you out there?
What, are you asking me?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay. So you're saying what?
What do the kids have to understand? Because we're seeing, because what we're seeing, King and Cello, we're seeing something where, and we still got time, so I'm gonna be a little long with it, but I'm gonna try to run a marathon saying it. We saw a time where gangster rap came into the fray. And if you knew the West Coast, if you were from it, because the East Coast wasn't really up on the West Coast gang politics back then. So it was a situation where in the West Coast, you could be from a set. Like, we know that Dub C is Crip. We know that Eazy-E was Crip. We know that DJ Quick is a Blood. You know, you know, Eazy-E, you know, we know that MC8 is Crip. We know that, you know, a lot, you know, and we know a few of these people. You know,
Mac 10,
you know, Inglewood, you know, Queen Street Blood, you know. So we know a lot of these people. You know, we know of, or these people know us, or we know them directly, you know. So even with the West Coast music culture, for what was considered mainstream gangster rap, you never really heard anything about a nigga dissing a neighborhood or, you know, or just like, you know, fuck Slav, you know, crab ass, you know. Well, then again, you had the Bloods and Crips album released March 9th, 1993. And that's why that record was so monumental. Shout to Red Rum, Tweety Bird Loc, Danny Girl, A-Love. You know, because that record was really, to me, the first rap gangster rap record that really told it about the L.A. gang life.
Yeah.
From niggas that really lived it. But
you know your history.
Go ahead, please.
No. I just want to give you a compliment. I said you know your history, man, when it comes to that hip hop.
Yeah. You know, so that was an album that was monumental. Shameless plug for those who want to pick it up on eBay. It's crazy expensive now, but if you can get your copy of it, go get it, because you're hearing those gangster rap stories from the niggas that really lived it. You know, Domino, of course, shout out to him because he represented Long Beach. You know, A-Love, he represents the Atlantic Drive, Compton Crips. Shout out to him. We interviewed him last year. You know, of course, you know, Bronco from Watts Fudgetown Crip. You know, we interviewed him last year. All solid guys. But people got to understand, like, this shit is real in the streets. But see, back in the day, you, even the West Coast knew, if you got out there on some shit talking about a set, you know, like, fuck, you knew there was some smoke coming behind it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. Back then?
You knew.
Oh, you knew, for sure. They was trying to shoot up your mama house. Somebody was trying to die.
Yeah, you know, you weren't going to be from, you weren't going to be from Tragnew talking about, you know, fuck Treetop. You know, like you say that, that's a declaration of war right there. You know, you know, even when MC8 and DJ Quit were going at it, you know, and really that was a misunderstanding. I'm so glad that later in the years, you know, that they, over 24, 25 years now, they've been okay. You know, but really that beef between them was a misunderstanding. But even then, you never felt like it was actually somebody who was going to die behind that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now we got these kids coming in, a lot of them talking about, you know, I mean, they straight calling out sets. You know, they like, fuck your side, nigga, we sliding, we riding. And I'm like,
man,
y'all do.
But look at how disrespectful it and got now, though. Like,
They're not even
disrespecting the niggas that's alive that's rapping. They disrespecting the dead. That would never happen back then.
I mean, yeah.
You smoking on my dead homie? Like, oh, it's war forever after that. You can't
like,
apologize for that. You know what I'm saying?
Man, right.
Yeah. But back to your question, what was you asking?
just what do kids have to understand about, because we see more of these kids now really trying to jump into it to make a point.
Oh, man, look, I'm glad you said that. I just had a conversation with my son. My son's 16.
Mm-hmm.
He in high school.
Yes, sir.
And he's in that age range where...
That awkward transition phase.
Yeah, where the street life is curious to him. Like, it's kind of infatuating, right?
Right.
He's a black man, ain't never been in the hood. He's straight been suburbs whole life. Never been exposed to gang culture other than through family members. You know what I'm saying? So seeing him and having the conversations that me and him have, it's just like, bro, you don't want to – we had to do that. We had to live that life because of our environment. Nowadays, these kids are trying to choose to jump off the porch and live and get involved in that life, and they're not even in the hood. You know what I'm saying? Like, these kids not even from the hood. Parents, good parents, good homes, and they out here trying to be Crips and Bloods and GDs and BDs and Vice Lords. And it baffles me because I always try to tell them, and I'm talking about his friends, and I tell them, like, yo, we did that because we had to. We had to survive. So we had to stick together with the people that was in our neighborhood. You know what I'm saying? As opposed to you in high school and you banging at school. You banging in high school. We ain't even do that. We caught you on the street and we got busy. But you doing it in school and you think you gangster. Like, bro, that's not gangster. Matter of fact, what's gangster is not doing it and doing the right thing, not getting involved and living the life that you're supposed to live, finding your purpose. And that's what I want to tell all the youngest, man. All of them should know that. Like, bro, the niggas that you see glorifying and being involved and being active, it's because they have to. It's the environment they're in. If you're not in that environment, man, everybody's trying to escape that. Why you think we was hustling trying to get money? Was to get out the hood, not to go into the hood and be the biggest gangster in the world. No, that was just part of being there. So any young kid that listen to this or that hear anything that I got to say that involving, like, the street life, man, one, it's not worth it. You get nothing out of it. And I like math, right? So I break it down to him when I talk to him. I say, look, you sell drugs for 5 years. In that 5 years, you make $100,000, right? You're selling drugs, make $100,000. You in the gang, you getting money. You get locked up. You do 10 years. Take that $100,000 and divide it by 10 years. That's how much money you made a year. And when they look at the number, and they look at where they're going to be at,
4,000 a year,
15, 20, you see what I'm saying? So when you break it down and you look at the numbers,
yeah,
it's like, yo, you did all of that. Now you in prison making 35 cents at the highest pay, 35 cents. 10 cents if you just clean them pods and all that. But if you a cook or somebody important, you making 35 cents an hour. That's what you moving towards. That's your future. 35 cents an hour. So I always encourage a man to look at life differently, and not to let the music control their mindset. And it's hard to say that because I know a lot of these kids are influenced by the music and the culture, and they want to be tough. They want to be this. You know what I'm saying? But man, it's not worth it. At the end of the day, when you add it all up, from the people, the brothers that I done lost in the game, shout out to the whole NFL, my nigga Don, rest in peace. Shout out to Twan, Top, Butter, Donis. You know, I got a nice squad, man, but we all grown now. Everybody married, got kids. We trying to live life on a whole different level, and we come from that. So I never tell anybody to backtrack or, you know, jump off the porch and get out there. Man, stay away from it. That's what I got to say about it.
And that be going on here, right? And that be going on here, man. What was your first taste for the love of boxing, man? Like, what was the first fight that you ever seen? You'd be like, okay, this is what we want to partake in.
Now, when I got into the box, man, Tyson, bro, like, Mike Tyson. Like, I heard about Muhammad Ali, but my first experience of seeing a fight was Mike Tyson. And I forgot who he knocked out, but
Trevor
it was
Burbitt?
A big white dude.
Oh, okay.
Nah, it was a real big white dude, man. He knocked them clean out. They was talking trash, all that. Man, he popped the dude. I was like, oh, I love this. And I was, you know, I was super young at that time. Like my brother said, he got into boxing at 15, but prior to that, we was exposed to boxing because that was one of the only activities we had in our gym, like in the neighborhood gym that we was in, was to box. It was like boxing pads and all that type of stuff. So he was exposed to it prior to that. But he took it serious once he got out to Vegas. But yeah, man, Mike Tyson for sure is the catalyst for my interest in boxing. And then to be blessed and have a brother that becomes a professional fighter, you know, and then get signed to one of the best fighters of all time, one of the greatest, one of the GOATs, Floyd Mayweather, you know, that's just that's a big deal. And once my brother became that guy, once he got signed, like before he took it serious, like when he was taking it serious, I was just like his big brother. Yeah, man, go to the gym, you know, work out, stay in shape. But when he got signed and he started fighting pro, that's when I just started digging in to boxing 100% all the way around, from the business to the actual training, like everything.
Tell us about that transition you made into the management, because this is where your entrepreneurial journey starts.
Right. So this is definitely where that start. So I'm going out to his fights. I'm around Floyd. I'm around Floyd's entourage. I'm around his family. You know, I'm going to his mom's house to barbecues and just being around that environment. It was like, whoa.
Oh, you in.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, you know, I'm at his sister's house. Like, we, after the fight, cookouts. You know what I'm saying? We in there, all that. We doing all that. But my brother, he gets fine. He does his first couple of fights, and I don't go. So I'm just like, you know, good luck. You know, you got this. We're from a distance. And he's going. At this time, he's signed as management to one of Floyd's cousins.
Okay.
Right? So he's signed to Mayweather Promotions, TMC, for the promotion side. And then on the management side, he signed to Floyd's cousin. So I'm going to say about 3 years go by, and it's bad blood between my brother and the manager. You know what I'm saying? There's issues going on between them where they not trusting each other. The manager is lying and telling Floyd one thing and then telling my brother something different. And, you know, it created bad blood between Floyd and my brother. So my brother was like, man, I got to fire. I got to get rid of him. So I was like, man, you know, what you going to do? And he straight up told him, like, hey, I need you to start learning about this boxing game. Like, that was literally his conversation with me over the phone. I was like, I need you to start learning about the boxing game. I was like, say less. I went into research mode. You know what I'm saying? I went straight into research mode, how to manage professional athletes. I'm looking up stuff. I'm looking at classes because I'm trying to go all in for bro. Like, I'm
He, at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm listening.
Yeah, because people don't understand. You have to be certified. You have to have a license to do this.
Exactly. So I'm not just trying to step in here as the brother that's just, you know, here to be in your ear. I'm trying to step in and be that guy that's certified, that know what he's talking about, that can walk into these rooms and deal with the promoters, that can talk to other managers, that can get you funding from corporations. Like, I'm trying to be that guy. So when he gave me the green light to just, I mean, he gave me that motivation to just, like, get into it because he was talking about pulling me in, I went 10 toes in. You know what I'm saying? I just started learning on my own, started taking some classes, and then, you know, started researching how to become an agent, putting up money for classes on my own, And I did it. You know what I'm saying? It took about 3 years, but it was accomplished. You know what I'm saying? And now, ever since then, you know, I was his manager. And what we do now is we do what we call co-management deals, where I'm his manager. I run everything as far as the money team with Andrew. And we bring another management team in that might be from the UK that can help us get fights over in the UK. Or
right.
They might have some connections over in Saudi Arabia or, you know what I'm saying, Dubai, things of that nature. So we're definitely linked with people, the business, and bring other managers in that I might not have the connections or the expertise in that country or state. Or, you know what I'm saying? Like, we definitely do that. But when it comes to him, I run everything. And he gave me the opportunity. Like, that's how it was. That's how I ended up being blessed and getting into managing athletes in general.
Now, the situation with Floyd, because obviously there was a bit of a turbulence at the time. How did y'all manage to straighten that whole situation out?
So this was, now I do have to backtrack a little bit. So when my brother got signed, Floyd's dad was his main coach. So Floyd Mayweather Senior is his coach. So we got a direct link to Floyd. So, you know, we know that it's bad blood between the manager. I don't want to say his name. You know what I'm saying?
Understood.
The manager
understood.
And my brother.
Understood.
Yeah, so we know, you know, at that time, we know that it's bad blood, but we trying to figure out a way to make it happen, like to make it work, but it just wasn't working. And with the issues that was going on, and I'm going to give you an example of some of the issues that would happen. So a fight opportunity might come up, right? And the manager would say, hey, don't take the fight. If it's for this amount of money, we need more money. So I'm going to ask for more money. So my brother would be like, okay, cool. And then that same manager would go and say, hey, Andrew said he wants this amount of money or he not fighting, as opposed to saying,
ooh,
you know, I'm the manager, he deserved this amount. So it looked like we was demanding, when I say we, me and my brother, was demanding more money than we were supposed to be paid for fights and basically denying fights when that never happened. Like, we're being told, hey, you need more money for this fight. So, all right, cool. Go get it for us. And then on the other side, it's like, oh, man, he want all this money. You know, woo, woo. So now it's looking like, you know, Floyd is the promoter. So now it's looking like, okay, now you're asking for all this extra money, but this is the money I promised you, and you agreed to it. Now you're saying you don't want it. You need more. And it was never my brother saying that. That was his cousin.
How did y'all get to the bottom? How did y'all get to the bottom of it?
We got to the bottom of it by firing him. And then his Floyd's dad, Floyd Sr., was able to speak on our behalf at times. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So that's what helped us get to the bottom of the little issues that was going on between them. And, you know, still, it's just like, it's hard when it's your cousin. You know what I'm saying? Like, this your blood cousin. So who you going to believe? Some nigga you sign? Or your cousin who's in and out the crib, got cousins and nieces, and you know what I'm saying? Like, that's your blood. Like, you still kind of believe your cousin at the end of the day. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have the direct access to just, we do, but a lot of times when we around, we kind of try to keep business separate from the moment. Because in the moment,
understood,
it might be right after Floyd's fight. Or in the moment, we might be at his mom's house, and it's not time to talk business. We out celebrating. Or, you know, we didn't have, like, a lot of times when we was able to talk business, it would be about the business in that moment. So it wasn't like we could backtrack and say, hey, remember what happened back then? This is what happened. We never really had the opportunity to go back and rehash it. It was just like, it kind of just died out.
Got you. And you know, one thing about it, Cello, that's one thing about it that people, you know, people got to understand about it with money. Now, we're not saying in y'all case in terms of it, just in terms of how these fighters get this big money for the super fights, as they say, because people think that fighter gets all the money. No, that's not what happens. That money, if somebody gets a $40 million fight purse, that means that goes for everybody. That goes for the trainers. That goes for the cooks. You know, that goes for everybody.
Whenever you hear about a fighter getting paid, the fighter is taking 20%.
Wow.
So if you hear about a fighter talking about he getting 10 million, he's only getting 20% of that.
That's 2 million.
Thanks. You understand what I'm saying now?
The cut man needs a cut.
Man, you got to pay the cut man a percentage. You got to pay your coach a percentage. You got to think these guys are doing. These guys are hiring chefs for the entire 8 to 10 weeks they training. Then you got meal prep.
That's their livelihood.
You got to pay for the meal preps. You got to pay the promoter. You got to pay the manager. And most manager fees are between 25 to 33% max. So, it's really like that. Like, some boxers, man, boxing is a poor man's sport. Floyd was blessed because of who he had in his corner. He had his team was impeccable.
Shout out to Al
Haymon. That's what I was just going to say, bro. Once he linked up with Al
greatest
Haymon,
black man that ever been created.
Hey, for real. He linked up with Al Haymon, boy, and stole the game.
We love him at Off the Cuff. Shout out to Al Haymon. You know,
hey,
man.
And he do all his business do it, and he do all his business do a flip phone, man.
Hey, he got about 4 of them, too. Hey, for real, though. Yeah, shout out to Al Haymon. Shout out to Sam Watson. Shout out to Sam Watson and the whole squad, the brothers, the sons, all of them, man. They're some good dudes, man. For real.
Man, look, we know Al be chilling, man. Tell him come out of hiding. Tell him we want him on the show, man. His history is incredible.
Good luck with that, T-Bax, man.
It ain't enough money in the world to pay him to do an interview.
We just got a late message. That's like the Don Corleone of boxing, son. You ain't gonna be able to get to that man.
Hey, unless you walking past him and he in the stands. I'm telling you.
But I want to ask you this too, man. I was gonna ask you this too, because you know we talking about boxing, man, and you know, with boxing comes is critics. You know what I'm saying? You know, you have critics talking about Floyd's undefeated record. You know, about him ducking fights and him being cherry picking fights. Like, what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, when it comes to boxing, man, it's you don't really like Floyd is a different beast, man. Floyd is the GOAT. You know what I'm saying? So once he reached a certain level, he was able to decide who he was going to fight. But you got to look at everything before that. Before he got to that level, he fought everybody that was good on his way up. So once he got to the point where he became the boss, I can fight once or twice a year if I want to. You know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, I want to fight this guy. He called me out. Let me fight him. Either way, he's getting the bag, and he's blessing whoever he fights, because whoever he fights is going to be rich after that. So he had the ability to do that. Like, it's respecting it because he earned it, to be real. He earned it.
And, I mean, in terms of how he figured out, because people got to understand it. One thing about Mayweather, we have always respected his hustle and his business acumen because he figured it out, like you said. He became the draw. And if he's the draw, it's like, nigga, I'm the draw. You got to pay me to show up.
As he would say, the A side.
Right. Exactly, bro. Exactly.
So it's like,
imagine Jay-Z in his prime. Right.
Right.
And he still got to do shows in the nightclub. Going to do shows in the nightclub. Now he can choose where he's going to do his show. He can choose Madison Square Garden, or he can choose the Bull Stadium, or he can choose Wrigley Field, or he can choose, you know what I'm saying? Or he can choose who goes on his ticket, who's going to be his lineup on his concert. You know what I'm saying?
Great analogy.
Like before, right, before when he coming up, he ain't got a choice. The record label is choosing. The promoters are choosing. Now he gonna choose. Look what 50 just did. You know what I'm saying? Look at all the people he just put on, because he earned that. He can do a world tour and choose everybody he wants to be on there because he earned it. But back in the day, he couldn't do that. He had to be on stage with other people that wasn't G-Unit. And I use that analogy just to say that's how Floyd, you know, became who he is, man. He earned that. And by the way, he didn't cherry pick his fights. A lot of the people that he chose to fight were people that called him out and that was in line
to
fight him.
That's true.
Maidana, Canelo. You know, everybody be like, oh, Canelo was younger. He wouldn't beat the new – bro, Canelo was in his prime and got beat by one of the best and the greatest and learned from it. And now look at Canelo. You know what I'm saying? Like,
Canelo is just – Canelo serving him.
That's what I'm saying.
But one thing I respect about Canelo, though, Canelo took that L like a man, and he never talked shit after that. He's like, you know, I lost, and I just move on.
That's a fact. That's a fact. That's one of the reasons why I feel like everybody got behind Canelo, is because he took that L, and nobody really expect. I didn't expect Canelo to beat him or even come close to beating him, but I just knew that whoever fought Floyd was going to be famous after they fought him.
And Canelo,
whoever
gave
he gave that
fight.
Opportunity to. Yeah.
Yeah, and Canelo gave him a good fight. You know, Canelo ain't lay down. Yeah. Canelo gave him what he could do. And, I mean, he didn't beat him, but he let everybody know, like, nah, nigga, I ain't, guess what, I ain't laying down either.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I love about boxing, man, because, you know, one of the things I feel like Floyd has tainted boxing just a little bit is because now everybody think you got to be 50-0. Everybody think you got to be have a perfect record. And when you really look at the history of boxing, all your greats have losses. Floyd,
here's
one thing I don't like is
how they make it like if a guy takes an L that his career is over, just like they did with Errol Spence and Crawford. They make it like, yo, Spence is done. I'm like, he just took a loss.
That's it. His profession is to fight. So whether he lose or win, he's a fighter. That's how he feed himself. So he just got to get back up, get back in the ring, and fight again. That's it.
Just like with Deontay Wilder. You know, it's like,
yep.
You know, it's going to happen.
And Wilder fighting in Saudi Arabia on the 23rd, I think. Shout out to Wilder. That's one of our people. You know what I'm saying? That's one of our people. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Now, Cello, you don't just necessarily do boxers. You do athletes from all walks in terms of NFL, NBA. Tell us about that in terms of crossing over into that.
So, once I got to the point where, you know, I got a little bit of notoriety, me and my brother decided to start a management company together. And basically, we meet athletes all the time, and we let them know what we do, what we're about. And the main thing that we tell these athletes is we're trying to set up your life after the sport.
Sure.
So yeah, we're gonna make sure while you're in the game, you're taken care of, everything is right. But when the sport is over, you get injured or something, what is that life like for you? We want to prepare for that. So that's one of my biggest selling points, is to make sure that, you know, these athletes that come work with us, they know we're trying to set up life after the sport. We want you to be rich after the sport is over with, when you can't play no more. We want to set up things like that. So that's kind of what pushed us into becoming entrepreneurs and getting into investing and, you know, starting businesses, because those are the things that we're trying to get the athletes involved with. So I've met a lot of athletes, man, that didn't even know what a mutual fund was. Mm. Like, how you making all these millions and all this money, and you only got one house, and that's the one you live in? You don't have no properties. You don't have no investment properties. You don't have no investment. You know, mutual funds, no stocks, no bonds, no nothing. Like, what's going on? And they're fine. They got managers. They got agents. They, you know, but nobody's schooling them on how to maintain those finances and how to build wealth outside of the sport, because they blowing their check. They blowing the money fast.
Now, we got a little bit of time left, Cello. One thing about it, shout out to ESPN on the 30 for 30 series where they did the broke.
Oh, yeah.
I think you saw that. They said that, like, they said over 60% of athletes within 4 years retirement, they end up broke because all those bills catch up, because they buy so much. And then when them checks stop coming, but the bills don't stop coming. Right.
That's a fact.
So this is
one of the things I tell my guys. You're a single man, right? Why are you buying a $5 million mansion? And ain't nobody living in there but you. You might move your mama in there. Why?
Right.
To keep up with the Joneses, to look like the money. Like, forget, you know, and it's a cultural thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, we as a people, we like to look like. We like to look like we got it. And it doesn't stop when they actually have it. They like to look like they got it even more, and they overextend themselves to the point where they're actually in the negative. I'm talking about getting checks, and the check is already spent. And now they don't have no spending money. It sounds crazy. I can't put no names out there, but I'm just saying, like,
we know a few of them. Say less. We know a few of them.
Yeah, I'm serious, man. Like, I'm talking about how you get a $750,000 check today, and at the end of the month, you broke. Make it make sense. And that's what I try to teach my guys, man. My team is a family. You know what I'm saying? We move like a family, a brotherhood. Yeah, and that's how we move. And anybody that me and my brother bring along and put on this team, that's how they're going to have to move. I would rather drop an athlete that's not willing to adhere to the advice and the knowledge that I'm bringing than to have somebody that's going to just continue to ruin and ruin their life under my name. Like, I just, yeah, bro, if you're going to do that, ain't no need for us to be here.
And that's a representation of y'all. That's a representation of y'all, that athletes start acting crazy.
Exactly. I mean, we coming with everything. We bringing the whole package. We bringing the lawyers you need. We bringing the accountants you need. We bringing all the investment specialists. We bringing everything to the table that you need to be successful outside of your sport. All you have to do to show up to the meetings, give permission for certain people to do certain things, and the things they're doing, yes, you might have to pay them to do it, but in the long run, you're going to be set for life. So, and that's hard to tell somebody that's 23 just getting signed to the NBA. You know what I'm saying? And they're getting a few million, or, you know what I'm saying? Or they're getting signed to the NFL fresh out of college, and they're getting them millions. They see them M's, and they got families and cousins, and you know what I'm saying? So, like, remember, I'm coming from the outside. I'm coming from the outside in. They got a whole mindset already set with people feeding them the garbage that they are pushing that's causing these guys to go broke.
And y'all do those deals from all aspects in terms of endorsement deals too, correct?
We do everything. All the endorsement deals, everything go through us.
Okay, cool. Because we're Nike guys over here. If y'all got any Nike stuff, did they
look, you know what's crazy? Hey, look, I'm gonna keep it 100 with you. Look, my brother want to get signed to Nike so bad, and that's
right.
The one brand that we have not been able to break into. That's
not even one
brand. None. Yes.
Because I know with, I think, what's his name? Andre Ward, yes. And with Tim Brown.
Yeah, Andre Ward got the Jordan. Yeah, he got the Jumpman, the Jordan joint. I don't know how he got that. But, hey,
Mike,
shout out to
usually
him.
Usually that's a situation where you think of Roy Jones Jr. back in the day, he had the Jordan endorsement.
Yeah, that's one of those situations, man. You got to know somebody that knows somebody and be in the right room at the right time to get tapped into that. That's not no cold call. Like, I can't make a phone call to corporate and then get tapped in. Like, you got to really have somebody that's in there. Yeah.
Man, we already got to have to do a part two with this.
Oh,
obviously,
good, because I'm going to let my brother back home.
Man, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
We got to talk some business once we get off this call. So I'm going to call you once we get off this phone. Cello.
And we didn't even get into the Knockout Beers, the other company that I got. Like,
that's, we're
going to
do that for part two. Man,
yeah,
all right. Look, that's part two. You just let us know when y'all available, and we'll get it done.
Hey, I appreciate that, man, and I appreciate y'all for the opportunity to even get on here and talk and rap with y'all and just talk about myself. Because, you know, like I said, I'm not nobody famous. I'm just a black man in America trying to make it, and I'm trying to make it by any means necessary except for illegal means. You feel me?
But your story is one of, you know, initially hardship, perseverance, then triumph. And perpetually success. You and your brother are both epitomes of black excellence and doing it the right way. You know, y'all are an inspiration. Shout out to Nene from Brutally Opinionated Podcast. We are honored and privileged to have had you both on the show, and we can't wait to have y'all back on again. Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, brother, and I appreciate you. Shout out to Nene, like you said, for linking us up together. And, man, I can't wait. I got so much more heat for you. I don't even know. I don't even want it to end right now. I'm ready to keep going.
King is the Al Heyman of Off the Cuff Radio, you know, because he does so much with this, you know. So
yeah.
Just hit King, you know, and just let him know when you want to come back on.
What did he say?
I said, yeah, we definitely going to keep in touch, man. So
yeah, sure.
We got a lot of things lined up. That is just the beginning.
Hey, look, and I got some other people y'all need to get on here, man, and we're going to talk about that off the air, but I've definitely got some people I'm going to send your way.
Absolutely. We appreciate you so much. There's a couple other people that we need to get you in touch with, too, to get on their platforms. You know, because we definitely don't want Blog Talk cutting us off after such a spirited and inspiring dialogue. Yeah, man. Thank you again.
Hey, big up to y'all brothers, man, for doing this. For real.
Absolutely.
Definitely, man. Yeah, let me get up out of here, yo, before they cut us off, man. We definitely appreciate the bill, man. So we're going to keep in touch.
All right, brother. Peace. Hey, I appreciate you. All right. Peace out.
God bless. Thank you again. Brother King, take us out of here.